Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to you all to this June seminar of the Ferhat Emorachev of Contemporary Thought, to the John Searle's seminar. I think there is no point in presenting John Searle. Anyone who has who is in philosophy is aware of the importance of this seminar and aware of the importance of John Searle's contribution to philosophy of mind, to a philosophy of knowledge, philosophy of language, cognitive science in general, to the metaphysics of the social. So since there is no point in trying to present John Searle, I am not going to present John Searle. He himself will present by giving these lectures. The seminar is going to proceed in the following way, as usual. First, he will give a talk, a lecture. Then we'll have a debate on the subject he will have dealt with. Then we'll have a coffee break here in the cloister outside. Then we'll come back in again, and we'll have the second lecture. This is going to be hard work. This is going to be real hard work. But as you will see, he's in very good health condition. He's very strong and enthusiastic. So you can ask him hard and interesting questions. So nothing more. Thank you all for being here. Thanks also to Nicole Badobinac for being here, to Joseph Mural for being here and joining us in this seminar. And above all, thank you, John, for being in the Ferhat Emorachev. We are yours. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank you for that very generous and pleasantly brief introduction. Also, while we're giving thanks, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me, and I want to thank all of you for being able to listen to a lecture in English, American English. I think it's a stunning fact that people are willing to listen sometimes for a whole hour to a lecture in a language that is not their own. I could never do it. I don't have the patience. I would go to sleep I'm not encouraging to go to sleep. But anyway, I'm thanking you for your willingness to listen to a lecture in English. And I'm going to just talk. And I don't know how the organizers want to organize the question. But if I say something you disagree with or don't understand, just raise your hand. And please stop making flashes. I don't have any notes, so it's hard if there's a flashing going on. If they need a device, I have a thing called a cell phone, and he can use it to take pictures without a flash. Okay, now I'm going to talk about, in a sense, the current condition in philosophy, but I'm going to talk also about my own development as a philosopher. History of my own work in philosophy only became apparent to me what I was doing after I'd been doing it literally for years and years. So let me situate the enterprise within the overall intellectual environment in which we find ourselves. Central intellectual fact about the present era is that knowledge grows. We just know a lot more than our grandparents did, and our grandchildren will know lots more than we do. Commencement lectures like to say knowledge grows exponentially, but they haven't thought about what an exponent is. It doesn't grow exponentially, but it does grow prodigiously, and it is an amazing fact that we know so much. Now, this development, the sheer growth of knowledge, has changed the nature of philosophy in a couple of ways that I want to mention. First of all, for the three centuries after Descartes, the dominant question in philosophy was epistemic. How can we know anything for sure? How can we answer skepticism? Now, that question, how can we answer skepticism, doesn't have the force for us that it had 100 years ago or three centuries ago. And the reason is that we're now confident about a great deal of our knowledge. It is very hard to send men to the moon and bring them back and then ask, do we really know that the external world exists? Or do we really know that the earth is round? So the sort of skepticism that occupied philosophers for so long now can't have that meaning for us. There are still skeptical questions, but they're a bit like Zeno's paradoxes about space and time. In order to go from here to the door, I have to go half the distance. And in order to go that half, I have to go half of the half. And in order to go half, well, you know how it goes. But no one at the end of Zeno's paradoxes thinks, well, then I can't really walk to the door. And that's a bit how we are with the skeptical paradoxes. They're to answer, how do I know I'm not a brain in a vat deceived by an evil demon, and so on. But in the end, we don't really doubt that we have a secure knowledge. And that's a contrast with the 17th century. In the 17th century, knowledge was genuinely problematic. The existence of a universal, widely accepted knowledge of how the world works simply could not be assumed. Educated people in the 17th century believed in the existence of unicorns, and other such superstitions were extremely widespread. We don't have that problem today. Now there's a huge body of knowledge that we can simply take for granted. Furthermore, we have a technology that makes that knowledge instantly available. If you want to know the number of carbon rings in serotonin, that's a neurotransmitter, just Google it. Just look it up on the machine, and it's stunning how much sheer raw information is available to us. Okay, now a second effect of the growth of knowledge, it has altered the nature of our problem in philosophy. The central problem in philosophy is not to put knowledge on a secure foundation. Its existing foundation is secure enough. The central problem in philosophy is to make our total knowledge consistent and coherent. And here's the puzzle. We have a secure knowledge of how the world works at a fundamental level. It consists entirely of entities that we find convenient, if not entirely accurate, to call particles, like electrons and protons and neutrons and atoms and molecules. And these exist in fields of force and are organized into systems. But if that's the universe, if the universe consists of mindless, meaningless physical particles organized into ever larger systems where the systems are bounded by their causal relations, if that's the ultimate reality, then where does humanity fit in? We think of ourselves as conscious, mindful. We think of ourselves as linguistic, political, aesthetic, ethical. We think of ourselves as having free will and rationality. That's the human reality. Now, the central question in philosophy, and the one I will be addressing in these lectures, is how does the human reality fit into the more basic reality? And the question is not merely how can we make our human reality consistent with the basic reality of physics and chemistry, but ideally we should show how the human reality is a natural growth, a natural consequence of the more basic reality of electrons, protons, and neutrons. I want you to see how, given that you have electrons, it's inevitable eventually you will have elections. And given that you have protons, eventually you'll have presidents. And so it's not enough for me to show that you can keep both of these worldviews, the human and the basic, but that the human is a natural consequence of the basic. And I had been doing philosophy literally for 20 or 30 years before I realized that's what I was doing. My theory of speech acts was designed to show how when I make these noises through my mouth, they can be meaningful speech acts, and so on with other phenomena. Okay, so that's our question. Now you might think, well, let's just get busy and solve it. Not so easy. And the reason is we are the inheritors of two absolutely dreadful traditions. And I'm going to make it clear why I think these traditions are dreadful. The first tradition is the tradition of God, the soul, and immortality. And what that tradition says is, we, with our minds and our consciousness, we're not part of any physical world. We're part of the spiritual world. And the soul, the mind, is not a part of biology. It couldn't possibly be part of biology. Most of my students are amazed to discover how extraordinary Descartes' theory is. They're surprised to find that Descartes thought animals couldn't be conscious. This makes them nervous because they're all dog lovers and cat lovers. But you can see why Descartes has to say the animal isn't conscious, because the animal is a body. If we were just bodies, we wouldn't be conscious. What makes us conscious is that God attaches a soul. God knows where he attaches it, presumably in the pineal gland or somewhere. That's a big issue. But the soul is not a part of the physical world. And this tradition's called dualism, the tradition that says the mind is not part of the ordinary physical biological world. Consciousness is not an ordinary process like digestion. That has had a catastrophic effect on our intellectual life. Now, oddly enough, it's used by an equally catastrophic tradition that makes exactly the same mistake. That is the tradition of scientific materialism. Scientific materialism says, in opposition to dualism, consciousness is not an ordinary part of the physical world. Now, what did the dualist say? The dualist said, consciousness is not an ordinary part of the physical world. The scientific materialist makes exactly the same mistake of supposing that consciousness cannot be an ordinary part of the world we live in, the world that includes digestion, photosynthesis, the secretion of bile, mitosis, meiosis, and all other familiar biological phenomena. So that is going to be my primary aim in today's lecture. I want you to see that our effort to get a unified conception of reality requires, first of all, that we assimilate consciousness to that reality. So that's the question I'm going to be addressing today. And that's how it fits in to the past three centuries of the history of philosophy. Now, as I said, I'm very grateful that you're willing to listen to a lecture, even though some of you were not born in the United States or other English-speaking countries. But is this okay for speed? Do you understand me? I am, like all American tourists, I am deeply convinced that if you speak English loudly, everybody will understand. Okay, so this is the principle on which I operate. Okay, now there are a couple of rather scholastic distinctions that I need to make before we can go any further. The first is a distinction in two senses of the famous tradition of distinguishing the objective from the subjective. And I have to tell you that this confusion is a source of enormous intellectual problems, and we'll see it when we talk about computational models of consciousness. So we look at this distinction between the objective versus the subjective, and we find that the distinction is itself systematically ambiguous between an epistemic sense, where epistemic means having to do with knowledge, and an ontological sense, where ontological means having to do with existence. Let me illustrate the distinctions. The epistemic sense of the objective-subjective distinction is a distinction between types of claims. If I say that a friend, Francesco Goya, was Spanish, that is epistemically objective. You can find out as a matter of fact. But if I say Francesco Goya was a better painter than Diego Velázquez, well, that's a matter of subjective opinion. That's the distinction between the epistemic sense of objectivity and subjectivity. It's a distinction between types of claims. However, underlying that distinction is a distinction in modes of existence. If you think of mountains, molecules, and tectonic plates, they have an existence that is entirely objective. It's independent of anybody's experience. But if you think of pains and tickles and itches, they only exist insofar as they are experienced. They are ontologically subjective as opposed to ontologically objective. Now, why is this distinction so great? Well, what we're going to find is, in the course of these lectures, we will frequently give accounts of phenomena where the account will be epistemically objective, even though the phenomena themselves are ontologically subjective. They'll be epistemically objective accounts of ontologically subjective phenomena. And just to give you a couple of examples, it's a pen that I have in my wallet are money in the European Union. But of course, the fact that makes it money is not a physical fact. It's a fact about our attitudes, and hence it has an element of ontological subjectivity. But it's an epistemically objective fact that it's a 50-euro note. This is important historically because when we talk about consciousness, which is the main topic of today's lecture, we will be talking about a domain that is ontologically subjective, but of which we can have an epistemically objective account. Now, this is important historically. When I first got interested in consciousness, I thought, the scientists need to figure out how the brain does it. They need to figure out how the brain causes consciousness. And I went to talk to neurobiologists at UCSF, the San Francisco branch of the University of California, where they have a very large neurobiological research. And I told these guys, what am I paying you to do? Get busy and solve the problem of consciousness. How does the brain create consciousness? And a standard answer I got was, on your own account, consciousness is subjective, but science is objective. So there cannot be a science of consciousness. Now, I hope you can see that's a fallacy of ambiguity. Science is indeed epistemically objective in that the science tries to give an account of reality whose truth or falsity doesn't depend on his personal attitudes. But the epistemic objectivity of the account of the domain does not make it impossible to have a scientific account of a domain that's ontologically subjective. Consciousness is ontologically subjective. It only exists as its experience. But a science of consciousness can be a science of like any other, even though the epistemic objectivity of the science has to be consistent with the ontological subjectivity of the domain. If you understand that, you will understand more than a lot of neurobiologists understand. And it's crucial that you should understand it for the account that I'm going to be giving. Okay, one more boring distinction before we get going on the meat of the subject matter. There's an interesting account of reality that we'll be giving. Well, we'll be talking about things like money and property and government and marriage. Now, all of those are what they are because people think that's what they are. And in that respect, they differ from mountains and molecules and tectonic plates. So we need a distinction between those phenomena that are observer independent, or we might say attitude independent, and this includes mountains and molecules and tectonic plates and those phenomena that are observer relative, and that includes money and property and government and marriage and universities and cocktail parties and summer vacations. And by now you will know that these contain an element of ontological subjectivity. It's only money because we think it's money. So you get ontologically subjective in the observer relative phenomena, but we should be able to give a scientifically objective and epistemically objective account of those phenomena, even though they are partly or entirely ontologically subjective. This is going to be important because when we talk about such phenomena as money and property, when I talk about civilization, we're going to be talking about phenomena that are observer relative. Even when we talk about phenomena of ethics and aesthetics, it's going to be observer relative. And our aim will be to try to get an epistemically objective account of these observer relative phenomena. I cannot tell you how much confusion is generated by a failure to understand these points. Now with all that under our belts, let us examine the problem of consciousness. Now, this is supposed to be a desperately hard philosophical problem. And we, my God, it's the traditional mind-body problem. Nonsense sounds better in French. Le corps et l'esprit. This is the problem we'll be talking about. I won't even try it in German, and I don't know the Spanish. But in any case, it's a problem with a long history in European civilization. And I'm going to argue that if you get clear about these distinctions I've been making, it has a rather simple solution. Okay, here goes. First of all, we have to define our terms. Consciousness is said to be very hard to define. I think, in fact, it's rather easy to define if you're talking about a common sense definition that identifies the target of the investigation. See, it's common to distinguish the common sense definition that tells you what you're talking about from the scientific definition that comes at the end of the result. So water, what's the definition of water? Well, it's this clear, colorless, tasteless liquid, and I'm about to drink some of it, and it falls out of the sky in the form of rain. And in Europe, you find yourself drinking a lot of it out of bottles. And it flows in rivers and streams. Now, that's the common sense definition. Later, you discover it's H2O. Okay. Now, with consciousness, we're still in the clear, colorless, tasteless liquid. We don't have a scientific definition. But it's very easy to give a definition of consciousness in common sense terms. Here goes. Consciousness consists of all those states of feeling or sentience or awareness. They begin in the morning when you wake up from a dreamless sleep, and they continue all day until you go to sleep again or otherwise become unconscious. On this account, dreams are a form of consciousness. So that's it. Feelings of feeling or sentience or awareness, they tend to go with wakeness, though dreams are also a form of consciousness. However, what we need to know are what are the features. That's just a general account of consciousness. And what we're going to show is that the construction of language and society and human civilization is based on consciousness, because the consciousness that we use to construct observer relative phenomena, such as money and property and government and marriage, that consciousness is not itself socially constructed. It's an observer-independent phenomenon. Now, here's the apparent paradox. All observed or relative phenomena are created by consciousness. Money, property, universities, government, marriage, cocktail parties, and income tax, all created by consciousness. But the consciousness that creates them is observer independent or intrinsic. It's not observer relative. How does that work? Well, we're not there yet. I won't even get that far today, but we will get an answer to that question. I can promise you that. Okay, so what are the features of consciousness? Well, now I'm just going to list a bunch of features. Fortunately, they've given me a generous supply of paper. Okay, now I go until 11 and then stop. Okay, all right, so here we go. Now we're going to launch onto features of consciousness. Well, the first feature is one that's frequently denied, and that is it's irreducible. You can't get rid of it. Now, my country is full of philosophers who want to get rid of consciousness. They think if you believe in consciousness, you're back in bed with Descartes. You have to believe in God, the soul, and immortality. But I want to say, no, it's just an ordinary biological phenomenon. But this is crucial. You can't get rid of it by showing that it's an illusion in a way that you can with the discovery of other scientific accounts of illusions. So we showed that sunsets are an illusion created by the rotation of the Earth on its axis. And we show that rainbows are an illusion created by the refraction of light through water vapor. Why can't we show that consciousness is an illusion? That's our first question. And the answer is this. The illusion-reality distinction with rainbows and sunsets rests on the distinction between how things seem to be consciously. Consciously seems that there's an arch in the sky or the sun is setting behind the mountains. How they seem to be consciously and how they really are. They really are something different from the way they consciously seem to be. But with the very existence of consciousness, you cannot make the distinction between how things consciously seem and how they really are. Because if it consciously seems to you that you are conscious, you are conscious. You see, I respect the neurobiologists, but if they come to me and they say, Searle, we've done a very careful study of your brain, and you are not conscious. We have figured it out. Your head is entirely full of straw. You can't possibly be conscious. I don't, look at my watch and think, well, these guys are pretty smart. Maybe I'm not conscious. I don't think that. I don't think you have to give in to experts, because where the very existence of consciousness is concerned, if it consciously seems to me that I am conscious, then I am conscious, because you cannot make the illusion reality distinction for the very existence of consciousness in a way you can for sunsets and rainbows and even colors and solidity. Now, of course, you can be mistaken about the details of consciousness. You thought you were in love, but it turned out you'd both had a lot to drink, and she looked awfully good in that light, and they were playing that damn Spanish music that they play, and you weren't really in love, but you did consciously think you were. But if you consciously think you're conscious, then you are conscious. Now, this is a central fact. Consciousness is a basic feature of our biology, and you can't get rid of it by showing that it's an illusion. Okay. But now notice, we're still talking about ordinary biological phenomena. There's no dualism, no soul, and no immortality. We're just talking about a functioning of the brain. The brain functions to produce consciousness. Okay, now the second feature of consciousness that it's essential for us to get at is that for every conscious state, there's something that it feels like to be in that state. There's what I call a qualitative character to every conscious state. Every conscious state has a feeling that is specific to that conscious state. So think of the difference between drinking water listening to music, and working on your income tax. Those are three different conscious states with three different qualitative characters. Now, because there's a special qualitative character, it is ontologically subjective. Consciousness only exists as part of a conscious being, as part of some human or animal. So you get an subjective ontology in consciousness. It's ontologically subjective, and that really follows from the qualitative character. But furthermore, there's a remarkable thing about consciousness, and this will be more important when we get to the creation of social reality, of money and property and government. All of our conscious experiences are organized within a unified conscious field. So I don't just hear the sound of my voice and feel the taste of the water and look at the people in the audience, but I have all of those experiences as part of a unified conscious field. Every qualitative experience, such as the taste of the water or the sight of the color red, is part of a big qualitative experience, the total unified conscious field. Okay, well, let's keep going. There's some other important features, and one that's going to be very important for the course of this investigation is consciousness functions causally. Now, again, there are a lot of philosophers who say, well, consciousness couldn't function causally. How could thought move matter? You want to see how it works? I decide to raise my arm, and the damn thing goes up. Now, this is astounding to Cartesians, you see, but it's not astounding at all. I'll tell you how it works later in the plumbing, but the important thing is there isn't any doubt that consciousness functions causally. You know, it obsessed Descartes. How could it function causally? And the occasionalist said it can't function causally. God, I decide to raise my arm, and God raised it. God doesn't do me any favors, okay? I raise my arm, and here's an amazing fact. We don't say, well, the arm going up, that's like rain in California. Sometimes it goes up, sometimes it doesn't go up. No, it goes up when I want it to go up. I want to raise my arm, the damn thing goes up, and that's a stunning fact. We ought to take it seriously, because a consciousness functions causally, and it has this other feature, and that is intentionality. Our consciousness is typically directed at objects and states of affairs in the world, and we, in English, we have adopted the German word from Intentionalität, intentionality. It's unfortunate in English because it makes it look like there's a special connection with intending in the sense in which I intend to go to the movies. So I want to slow down and define intentionality. Intentionality is simply that feature of the mind by which mental states are about or of or directed at objects and states of affairs in the world. Not all of our consciousness is intentional in this sense. You sometimes have feelings of anxiety where you don't know what you're anxious about. You just feel anxious. But a typical feeling thirsty or seeing something on the opposite side of the room or hearing a sound, all of those have this intrinsic intentionality. They have directedness built into them, and I'm going to talk to you about the nature of intentionality. But it's important to see that from a Darwinian point of view, from the point of view of our survival, the intentionality of consciousness is essential because it enables us to relate to objects and states of affairs through our consciousness. Okay, those are the half a dozen main features of consciousness, but there are several that I want to mention, just so you're aware of them. consciousness is a stunning fact, and it is very easy to imagine a universe in which consciousness didn't exist, but luckily for us, it does exist. And in a sense, consciousness is extensive with the parts of our lives that matter to us because what the mechanism does, what our biological mechanism does, is create the experiences that we have. What are some other features of those experiences? Well, first of all, it seems to me you need a distinction between active versus passive consciousness. There's a distinction between my voluntarily and intentionally doing something and something just happening to me. It is the experience of free acting, of acting consciousness, that gives us the conviction that we have free will. I don't know if we have free will. I'll talk about it in the course of these lectures, but it's the active consciousness that gives us the conviction of our free will. Passive consciousness is typical of perception. So if I hold this cup up and look at it, it's not a matter of my free will that I see a cup. It's determined by the physics and the biology of the situation. Notice it's an important fact that we all talk about the freedom of action. Nobody talks about the freedom of perception. There's no problem of the freedom of perception. In a way, there is a problem about the freedom of action, and that's because there's a distinction between the active consciousness of doing something and the passive consciousness of experiencing something. Okay, some other features of consciousness. Well, one important feature is that all of our conscious experiences occur in some mood or other. It needn't be a mood that has a name, like being elated or being depressed, but there's a peculiar flavor to your conscious experiences. And you will see this if you undergo a dramatic change. You get home and you discover, oh my gosh, you have a letter from the income tax, and they want to investigate your returns because they think you're several thousand dollars behind and are probably facing criminal charges. Okay, this will change your mood. I promise you, it will change your mood. Or you get home. Once I got home and opened what looked like a boring envelope, I was about to throw it out, and it said it enclosed a check for $9,763, and it said you've been awarded this check because somebody's been printing your work without your permission, and this is the copyright settlement. I knew nothing about this. It came from a lawyer. Changed my mood. Okay, my mood went way up when I got this strange check. The irony, of course, was the people who had been printing my work were printing something I would have given to them for free if they'd asked me. But in any case, I was glad to have. Anyway, I had this mood-changing check. Okay, so there is always the mood, and the mood is related to, but not the same as a pleasure versus unpleasure feature of consciousness. And for any conscious event, there are such questions as, did you enjoy it? Was it fun? Was it annoying, depressing, exciting, exhilarating, ecstatic, or miserable, or boring, or tedious? And that just means for any experience, there is a dimension of the experience where such things as was it pleasant or unpleasant come into play. They are relevant considerations. All right. Well, I'll just give you some of these other features. Now, it seems to me also in consciousness, you have to make a distinction between the center versus the periphery. And this is often put in the vocabulary of attention. What are you paying attention to now, and what are you not paying attention to now? And we actually have a fair amount of neurobiological research on attention, on what it is to shift your attention. So right now, I'm not paying attention to these lights overhead. They're very much at the periphery of my consciousness. And in fact, it's almost irresistible to use searchlight metaphor. You can alter the focus of your consciousness at will. You can shine the searchlight of your consciousness on whatever you happen to be interested in, whatever you want to focus on. You have a center of consciousness as opposed to the periphery of consciousness. Now, there's another feature that's harder to describe, and that I will call the situatedness of consciousness. And that is, every conscious experience comes with a sense of such things as, where is this occurring? Where am I? You wake up in the middle of the night and you think, where the hell am I? Last night I wondered, where's my dog? Where's Darsky? No Darsky? I must be in a very strange place. Well, okay, this is what happens when you travel. But in a normal consciousness, you know such things as, what time of year is it? Have I had breakfast yet? What month are we in? Or in university, which semester are we in? And there's a depressing fact, when you get older, you have a kind of vertigo, a kind of dizziness, when you can't remember, where are we? Month are we in? What day of the week is this? A sense of the situatedness of consciousness seems to me a characteristic of consciousness. Okay, now there's another feature which is going to give us a lot of trouble, but I think you can't get out of it, and that is, I think any normal, non-pathological consciousness contains a sense of the self. It isn't just any old consciousness floating through, as Hume would have told us. But this is me having these conscious experiences. Even if I forget my name and forget where I came from, all the same, all of my conscious experiences occur to a single self. Now, when you talk about the mind, you're forced to talk about Descartes. And when you talk about the self, you're forced to talk about Hume. Because Hume said, there is no self. He says, philosophers tell us there is a self, but how do I find this mysterious entity? I clutch my forehead and I concentrate all my attention. Where is the self? It sounds better in German. Was bin ich? You know. Yeah, or wo ist das ich? You know, where is the self? You look for the self, and then says Hume, when I look very closely, what I find is there's a feeling of pressure on my forehead as I'm grasping my forehead. Is that the self? No, that can't be the self. Well, where is the self? Hume says, there is no self. Well, that's not satisfactory. Okay, there are certain colossal mistakes in the history of philosophy, and it's going to be very hard for us to overcome them. But let me mention a few of them. Before we break for our whatever we have, tea or coffee or stuff like that. Oh, first the debate. Okay, that's even better. Okay, now here we go. Here are the most horrendous mistakes. The first one I always already mentioned, and that's the famous struggle about the mind and the body. I think it's an idiotic mistake, and both sides are equally idiotic. There's one side is the side of God, the soul, and immortality, and the other side is the side of scientific materialism. They both make exactly the same mistake. They say consciousness can't be an ordinary part of the physical world. I want to say, of course, that's exactly what it is, as I have been describing it. Okay, that's mistake number one. Now, mistake number two, we owe to Hume, and that's a mistake about causation. According to that mistake, causation is not a real relation in the real world. In the real world, there's just a regular sequence of events, and we call some causes and some effects because they come before others. But there's no causal relation. The world isn't held together by the glue of necessary connection. I think exactly it is held together by the glue of necessary connection, and Hume was mistaken. Okay, a third mistake, and this is really horrendous, and that is the mistake that says you never see the real world. What you see is the effect of the real world on your nervous system. And then when Quine gave these lectures, I think he didn't talk about conscious perception. He talked about stimulus. There are these stimuli, and I respond to the stimuli. I don't give a damn about the stimuli. I see my hand. Now, there's a whole tradition that says, no, you couldn't see your hand. The most you can ever see are your own ideas, ideas in the mind. These are called ideas or impressions. Descartes and Locke called them ideas. Hume called them impressions. Kant called them representations. Many recent philosophers call them sense data. But you cannot see the real world on this traditional view. All you can see are your own impressions, sense ideas, and I want to say that is a catastrophic mistake. And it, but in case you think nobody held this, let me tell you who I'm talking about. Locke, Berkeley, Hume, Descartes, Leibniz, Spinoza, Kant, Hegel, Mill, just about everybody, all of the famous philosophers believed you cannot have direct perceptual access to the real world. Now, when we have a lecture on perception, I will argue that's exactly what we have, is I see the damn cup in my hand. I don't see a picture of the cup, a representation of the cup. I'm not responding to the stimulus of the cup. I actually see the cup, and let us use this dreadful expression, I see the cup in itself, the Ding an sich. You see, I would like to rewrite Kant, where you imagine him saying on the first verse of the Critique, where he says, typically in a perceptual situation, we see things in themselves, and we see them as they really are. I see a cup, which is a thing in itself, and I see it as damn near empty, and maybe that's a good excuse to stop for questions.
Okay. So do I just take questions from here, or how do we do it? Or do you want to call on people? What's the standard procedure?
We use the
microphone. Okay. You ask me questions then. Okay. He's going to get a microphone.
Yeah. Okay, and the procedure is usually from, since these people have many questions to put you, the ones who are close to you, we usually follow the rule of from back to the front. So first, and people have any questions here.
Here's a guy.
This person, yeah, first.
Hi, thank you. You have mentioned two main lines of discussion about the conscience. One of them is the religious one, is the thing that God plays our soul, and this leads to a non-existent conscience, non-physical conscience.
Yeah.
And the other one is the materialistic, the scientific.
Yeah.
But I think there is a third one. For instance, when David Chalmers says that the thermostat has conscience.
Yeah.
So how it fits in this?
Right.
In
well,
this?
There is, now, there are a number of, the mistakes that I mentioned are largely big, long-term mistakes, like dualism and materialism. There are local mistakes, which are features of our intellectual environment. And one, which I think I will talk about in the next hour, is functionalism. A functionalism says, what is the mind? Really, the mind is a set of causal relations between external stimuli, internal processes, and outward behavior. So what is it, for example, to believe that it's raining? Well, first, that belief is caused by a perception, and that perception, together with desires, causes behavior, such as carrying an umbrella. So if you ask the question, what is a belief really? A belief is anything that stands in those causal relations. Okay, now that view, I think, is not an intelligent view, and I'll refute it in the course of the next hour. But it has certain virtues. One is, it gets rid of any Cartesian entities. You see, I said nothing about consciousness or any of that sort of thing. There's just a set of causal relations. And those causal relations could be realized in a number of systems. And there's another magical word here, a magical expression, and that's multiple realizability. On the functionalist theory of the mind, the mental states are realizable in different sorts of systems. They're realized in neurons, in ourselves, and they're realized in computer chips, in computers. And I can't tell you how much they love this result. And then, of course, it turns out, well, there's nothing special about humans or animals. Anything can have a mind if it stands in the right causal relations. And guess what the leading candidate is? It's the computer. And the computers, as if you read the popular newspapers, they're now becoming much smarter than we are. And indeed, I recently reviewed a book that says the leading problem of the present era, and maybe the most serious problem that humans have ever faced, is that computers will become so intelligent that they will rise up and overthrow us all. And, you know, I think... Think of my shoes. They've suffered so much, but do I really fear one day they're going to come out of the closet and walk all over all of us? It's not going to happen. But this guy, it's a book I reviewed by a guy named Bostrom, and he thinks this is the leading problem humanity has ever faced, is the super intelligent computers will take over, and we will then become their victims. Okay, I'm going to attract this later. Okay, but now Dave Chalmers believes in functionalism. And I think, you know, there are always outrageous mistakes that philosophers make. Behaviorism was one, dualism was another. Functionalism is one of the latest, and I'm going to tell you about it more before we have lunch. Okay, you're going to hear more about functionalism. Okay, other questions? Oh, yes, this person had a question. Oh, you didn't have a question? Okay. I tell you an interesting fact. Cultures differ in how much women are eager to speak in public. In America, I have to make a point to call on girl students first because they're reluctant to speak in front of all these people. But Italy is totally different. When I lecture a lot in Italy, the first hands to go up are always from Italian women. I think they're wonderful. I don't know why this should be so, but they are. But guys are much more shy. The girls are much more aggressive. Anyway, I don't know the situation in Spain. Josef.
Thank you. Since we are going to talk about consciousness a lot in the rest of the talks, let me come back to this question of basic reality and human reality. I'm sure your point against, let's say, aggressive anti-realist is very sound and very persuasive. So if someone claims the real world does not exist, we cannot perceive it, whatever. But I'm kind of wondering, what would you say to a kind of peaceful transcendental idealist who would say, of course, people who want to deny the real world are wrong, but when it comes to cashing out, so to speak, this persuasion, anyway, in both your cognitive activities and practical acting, you anyway need to rely just on some kind of convictions of yours, kind of your conception of the world, so to speak. So do you not end up basically in the same situation? What is it that the transcendental idealist is missing who says, perhaps you are right on the kind of very abstract ontological point, but on practical matters you end up doing just the same as a transcendental idealist?
Yeah. Okay, now this is a beautiful question, and I want to say there's a big difference between me and the transcendental idealist. The difference is the Ding on sich. For the transcendental idealist, for Kant and his followers, you cannot see objects themselves. You cannot see the thing in itself. You only see your own representation. Now, Kant struggled mightily to show how we can have objectivity and common knowledge, even though we are idealists. That's because there is a reality that transcends our idealism, and that reality provides the grund, provides the ground of our representation, so we can have all that I want, publicity and public knowledge and society, and it gets even worse when you get to Hegel. You can even have objective Geist, you can have objective spirit. I think the whole thing rests on the mistake of denying that we see things in themselves. Of course, sometimes I don't see things in themselves if I've had a lot to drink or I'm sleepy or all sorts of things. But right now, under these conditions, when I'm fully awake, recovered from jet lag, I can see the damn cup in my hand. I see the thing in itself. And that's the difference between me and the transcendental idealist, in one sentence, is the access to the reality as it is in itself. They'll give you a microphone.
So you think that the human language can be objective?
It can be what?
Objective.
It can be epistemically objective, even though it is ontologically subjective. Now we're going to find it gets very complicated, because the actual marks that I make here, they are completely ontologically objective. But their having the meaning they do is observer relative, and consequently contains an element of ontological subjectivity. Now, I'm going to give you a theory of language and meaning in a later lecture, not today. I'm going to show that civilization, as we think of it, the civilization that contains the Spanish government and the Catalan government, that even contains the Football Club of Barcelona and the Roman Catholic Church, all of those phenomena are socially created by language, that we use language to create a reality that goes beyond language. So Barack Obama is president of the United States. What fact makes him president? Not a fact about his DNA or his biology, but a fact about the status and the position we have assigned to him, and that requires language. The creation of governments requires language, and I'm going to show you in a later lecture exactly how it works, exactly how we create money and government and private property and churches and football teams and summer vacations through the use of language. We create a reality by representing that reality as existing. I am a citizen of the United States, the holder of a California driver's license, and a professor in the university. Those are important facts. They're epistemically objective. I can prove all of those. But all the same, they contain an element of ontological subjectivity, because they only exist as such if we represent them as existence. And that representation requires language. So you put your finger on one of the central questions of these lectures. What is the role of language in the construction of social and institutional reality? Now, you have to be careful, because there's a class of people who think, well, maybe all of reality is linguistically constructed. No, that's ridiculous. There's a tiny little corner of our world that is linguistically constructed, but most of reality doesn't give a damn about us. It's ontologically objective, and it exists independently of any representation. Yeah, here's a question here.
I have a question. In the list of fixtures you gave us on conscience, there's something, I don't know whether it is missing, or, yeah. But it is astonishing when one sees the literature of the 20th century, not only in philosophy, but also in literature.
Yeah.
One sees how time, the idea of time, became central to and not only, I mean, think of Proust, but also think of Heidegger and many other people who said, well, time is a central feature of reality, because they saw time as being central to conscience. Yeah. When you were talking, for example, of situatedness,
yeah.
some might say, I don't know, even yeah. Henri Bergson might say, look, he's talking of a spatial, he's using a spatial metaphor. In fact, he's yeah. talking of time.
Oh, not just time, but Befindlichkeit und Geworfenheit. You know, I mean, we're really stuck with this dreadful vocabulary. But anyway, go ahead.
The thing is, it wouldn't be some time. Where does time fit?
Okay. Let me add to the list of features of consciousness, the consciousness of temporality, the consciousness of the passage of time, and the situatedness is always a temporal situatedness. I think that's right, but I don't understand it. I don't. Maybe some of you can explain it to me, but I do not understand time well enough to have an intellectual grip on how I would accommodate it in my theory of consciousness. The physicists tell us about space and time is very uncomfortable. See, it was very comforting in the 17th century to think, well, that the primary qualities of things like shape and position and movement and velocity, and the secondary qualities like color. But what Einstein showed us is that temporal movement alters the primary qualities. So it's only really square relative to a certain fixed position. If you get the object going close to the speed of light, it's no longer square. And indeed, it isn't just that it no longer looks square, it really isn't square. So we have these problems in the physics of relativity theory, and quantum mechanics is even worse. And I don't understand time well enough to have an intelligent opinion. That's why I didn't put it. But I'm perfectly happy to list it as another feature here, that a temporal situatedness. I think that's right.
One more thing about materialism that has always, I guess it's the eloquence that is sort of seductive, and I found it in Schopenhauer. He says, there is no object without a subject, and that to me is the most concise and, again, haunting way to put or case for materialism. And I wonder what you rely on in the world. Is it sort of, you know, dating, carbon dating, or something like geography? What is it, or what sort of schema do you rely on to refute that?
Yeah. Okay, I want to say the object-subject distinction is already part of the observer-relative set of categories. The intrinsic reality that I described to you of physical particles and fields, of course, that knows nothing about subjects. Then out of that, here's the sequence. You have a world that exists without any human or animal consciousness. What do you get? How do you get to that from the basic physical reality? And here we actually know some of the details, not all of them, but here it is. You have big carbon-based molecules with lots of hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen. Why we are so obsessed with these four elements, I don't know. Biologists have explained it to me, but I still don't fully understand it. So we have these big carbon-based molecules, and some of them amazingly replicate. They duplicate, and that is the beginning of life. Now, why and how did life begin? We don't know. Well, why am I paying these guys if they don't figure that out? But anyway, that's a problem. We know that life is a biochemical phenomena. But how did it begin on Earth? We don't really know the answer to that. How and where did it begin? We don't know. I hope we figure it out, but in any case, we don't know the answer. Okay, you have these carbon-based molecules that replicate. So you have the beginnings of life, and then some of them are organized into systems. and we then have systems that are alive and replicate, and eventually, after literally millions of years, they evolve into us. Evolution into living organisms, such as plants and animals, then involves the development in animals of living nervous systems. And there's an amazing feature about nervous human and animal nervous systems is they contain neurons. And when you get enough neurons operating in the right way, you get a systematic behavior of neurons, you get consciousness. We don't know how that happens. We know that it happens. We know that in our skulls, variable rates of neuron firings relative to different neuronal architectures create consciousness. How the hell does it work? There are a whole lot of people trying to get the answer to that, but we don't really know the answer to that. How does the brain create consciousness? But I think it's clear that it does happen, and consequently we ought to be able to figure out how it happens. So the whole idea of the object and the subject as identifying the object relative to the subject, that requires an apparatus that goes way beyond the basic facts. That requires an apparatus of consciousness that presupposes what I'm trying to explain. How do we get from the basic reality to the human reality? And what I, first of all, is identified consciousness. Now, in the subsequent part of this talk, I'm going to talk more about how the brain does it and why it's quite different from computation, but I haven't got there yet.
One last question. Where mathematical entities, where do they fit in subjective?
About these lectures, we're going to cover every conceivable philosophical subject. All right, now, for me, and here I'm going to speak very briefly because we don't really have a time to go into detail on this. Mathematics is not part of physical reality. It's part of our system of representing reality. So it's an epistemically objective fact that I have five fingers on this hand and five fingers on that hand. Both of those are epistemically objective, and I would say they're ontologically objective. It's just a plain brute fact. You want to see five, and here's another five. Now then the question arises, what is five? Okay, we all know what is a finger, but what is five? I love philosophy because only in philosophy are you allowed to ask questions like that. You see, you can't ask that of your arithmetic teacher. But philosophers do ask it. What is five? Okay, now Frege famously had an answer to that. I don't think it's the right answer, but I'm going to give you what I think is the right answer, and that's this. Numbers are properties of sets. So the set of fingers on this hand has a property which matches the property of the set of fingers on this hand. So the number five is not another finger. It's not another material object, but is a property of sets, and sets in an epistemically objective fashion have these properties. It's an epistemically objective fact that the set of fingers on my right hand has the same number as the set of fingers on my left hand. Now that's why Frege could say the number that belongs to the concept F is the extension of the concept equinumerous with F. That's one of the most profound things said in the history of Western philosophy, and I won't explain it to you because it goes far beyond these lectures, but Frege thought that he thought that numbers had to be sets of sets. I think that's the wrong part of Frege. I don't think a number is a set. It's a property of a lot of sets. And the number five is a property that's common to all five-membered sets, in the same way the color red is a property that's common to all red objects. And this has an unfortunate consequence. It leads to Russell's paradox. Now, most of my friends who make a living doing mathematics and set theory think Russell's paradox has been satisfactorily answered. I don't think it has. but I'm regarded as a Philistine and an idiot that I don't think that. Well, I might as well tell you what the problem is. Take any predicate. The predicate will determine a set. It will determine a set of those objects of which the predicate is true. So take the predicate, X is a horse, caballo. Take the predicate, X is a horse. That predicate will determine a set, as his extension, the set of horses. Now, there's an amazing fact about the set of horses. It's not a horse, right? It's a set and not a horse. So the set of horses is a set that is not a member of itself. Everybody with me so far? But now then you have a predicate. X is a set which is not a member of itself. And that's just like X is a horse. That will determine an extension. It will determine a set. Everybody with me so far? But now you're in very deep trouble. Because if you say X is a set which is not a member of itself, there must be a set of sets that are not members of themselves, the set of all sets that are not members of themselves. And now you have a deep problem. Is it a member of itself or not? If it's a member of itself, it isn't, because it's precisely a set of sets that are not members of themselves. On the other hand, if it's not a member of itself, it is, because it's precisely the set of sets that are not members of themselves. And that is the famous Russell's paradox. Russell put that on a postcard, sent it to Frege, and it ruined Frege's life when he saw the postcard he had. You know, there are great, the Western artistic tradition has wonderful ways of representing the same scene. Think of the Annunciation by Raphael as different from the various Annunciations by Botticelli. Totally different, same scene. Now I like to think, how would different artists represent Frege getting the postcard from Russell? And I think Munch. Munch is the best. The scream. In any case, now that you have one fact of very good fortune, and that is I'm not going to say any more about the philosophy of mathematics. Okay.
So, coffee break.